There was a time when movie studios just added Roman numerals to sequel titles. Think Rocky II, Rocky III, Rocky IV. Well, not anymore. This summer, we've had 22 Jump Street, the follow-up to 21 Jump Street, and X-Men Days of Future Past, with no mention that it's either the sixth or seventh X-Men movie, depending on how you're counting. This got our movie critic Bob Mondello thinking about the art of sequel titling.
Do you suppose they stopped numbering sequels so we wouldn't do the math, totting up time spent, dollars spent, watching the same plot play out with variations? 5 Die Hard, 7 Planets of Apes, 9 Elm Street Nightmares, a dozen Star Treks, Going Boldly, where pretty much everyone's gone by now. It makes sense a studio might want to downplay that, make things at least sound fresh, as with the Harry Potter and the movies, where book titles get our hero from preteen to young adult. Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, Prisoner of Azkaban, Goblet of Fire, until the last couple, where they settle for Deathly Hallows Part 1 and 2, which I guess they figured was better than Harry Potter and the male pattern baldness?
Oh, Harry, you need to shave, my friend. You know, at times, I forget how much you've grown.
Sometimes just using numbers for titles makes sense, as with Steven Soderbergh's Oceans trilogy about an ever-expanding gang of con artists staging ever more elaborate casino heists.
All right, gentlemen's down a three-number combination, 11, 12, and 13.
But if you're not going to go with numbers, sequel titling has rules. For an action picture, you want to up the ante each time. Die Hard, Die Harder, Die Hard with a Vengeance, or The Bourne Identity, Rising to Supremacy, and then Ultimatum, and then Simulacrum, or whatever that last one was without Matt Damon. If it's a horror flick, you want to add to the dread. Resident Evil's follow-ups were called Resident Evil Apocalypse, pretty dire, then Extinction, more dire, and then Afterlife, which was pretty much the only place they could go after Extinction.
What was that?
You're gonna need more ammo.
Comedy sequels get to have the most fun with titles, Naked Gun 2.5, for instance, and give the Dumb and Dumber folks credit for coming up with Dumb and Dumber-er, and for the three title that they've got coming in a few months, Dumb and Dumber 2, spelled T-O. Kind of meta. Others just go with puns, like Alvin and the Chipmunks, the Squeakwell.
I eat you for dinner, with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
There are occasional movie franchises where it doesn't much matter what you call the episodes. The series that has the most popular sequels in movie history.
Nobody does it better.
23 and counting?
Live and let die.
Doesn't acknowledge in its titles that the pictures are sequels.
Gold finger.
Presumably on the theory that with 007,
the sky falls.
Titles are forever, except of course for the impenetrable Quantum of Solace. Impenetrable because Quantum of Solace is both meaningless and perplexing. And the one thing you do not want your sequel title to do is raise questions. A while back, when producers were abbreviating everything, Mission Impossible 2, for instance, had posters that read M:I-2. There was a horror flick that wanted to try that, a sequel to Halloween that was supposed to be taking place 20 years after the first one. So the poster had Jamie Lee Curtis's face and great big letters saying H2O. It looked like she was selling a really sinister brand of bottled water.
Everyone is entitled to one good scare.
Another title that raised all the wrong questions was for a story about the king from whom we won our independence in 1776. In Britain, the stage play was called The Madness of George III, spelled George III in Roman numerals. But when it was turned into a film, the producers worried that Americans wouldn't know who George III was, so they added the word king, The Madness of King George, while dropping the Roman numeral at the end for fear that audiences would think they'd missed parts 1 and 2.
I am the king of England! No, sir! You are the patient!
What's the best sequel title ever? Well, reasonable people will disagree. But my vote goes to the Alien sequel, Aliens.
This is unbelievable.
How many?
Can't tell. Lots.
First time around, just one of those critters was plenty scary. This title promised, and the movie delivered, a whole planet's worth. It's not always easy to know whether a sequel has a good title until the movie arrives. I can't say The Avengers Age of Ultron means much to me at the moment. No doubt it will next summer, when the advertising is in full roar. Not sure what would be right for the rumored sequel to Shakespeare in Love. Woody Allen's already made a Midsummer Night's sex comedy. Love's Labor's Found, maybe? There is one upcoming title, though, that I'm prepared to say feels right. playing off nothing more than affection for a character who swam her way into audience hearts about a decade ago.
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming. What do? We swim.
Back
swim.
Then, she was looking for a hatchling named Nemo.
Dory. I love to swim in
Dory.
When you
now, she's apparently lost herself.
See, I'm gonna get stuck now with that song. Now it's in my head.
Sorry.
So the title, Finding Dory, just about perfect. I'm Bob Mondello.
Stars from across the galaxy are illuminating the massive convention center in San Diego, California this weekend. That's because it's time for Comic-Con, the annual pop culture convention that draws over 130,000 fans, many in elaborate costumes. Entertainment companies use the event to market and announce big projects, movies, TV shows, toys, and even some comics. NPR's Nina Gregory is there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with the movies. The film studios will often show extended trailers and sneak peeks of their upcoming movies. What are all the fans buzzing about this year at Comic-Con?
That's right, Renee. The movie studios do love to show off projects that are coming up months and sometimes even years from now. Sony had its big presentation already and showed some clips from Goosebumps, the movie based on the kids' horror books by R.L. Stine. It comes out in 2015 and stars Jack Black, and it went over quite well. There's also anticipation for Warner Brothers' presentation tomorrow. They're expected to show something from Mad Max Fury Road, which stars Tom Hardy as Max. That also comes out next year, and the director of the original Mad Max movies, George Miller, will also direct this one. And of course, Marvel is always a crowd pleaser here at Comic-Con, and they're expected to show something from the Avengers too. But I think one movie that everybody would love to see something from that won't be shown here is also worth mentioning, and that's Star Wars Episode 7 that's being directed by J.J. Abrams. It doesn't look like they're going to show anything from that. And despite all of the kind of fan adoration for these films and whatever buzz the studios might be able to generate, movies actually seem to be taking a backseat to TV this year.
Not actually surprising. I mean, TV is coming up with such dynamite fare these days. So what's big there? I'm going to imagine Game of Thrones is a crowd pleaser.
Certainly. And George R.R. Martin, who wrote the books the HBO show is based on, is here. He's doing book panels and signings. He's very much a man of the people. He walks around and talks and hangs out and shakes hands. But if you walk outside the convention center, many of the buildings around downtown San Diego are like wrapped up in banners promoting TV shows. There's just a ton of advertising, flyers, signage. And I have to say, they're actually getting quite creative in how they're promoting shows with all this competition for attention. You really have to stand out to get people's attention here.
So, Nina, let's go back inside and talk to us about what draws so many people to this multi-day event. I mean, I know one panel that was pretty heavily promoted was put on by NASA.
Right, Renee. And this panel went over really well. I spoke to a few people who were waiting in line to get in. It was filled to capacity, and there were still people who were hoping they could squeeze in. Here's one person, Gary Hayward, who really wanted to get in there.
It's science. Science and space. This is real. Like, yeah. It's something that we can actually do. We can actually go to space and not just read about it.
And then a few people in line down from him, and this is such a great Comic-Con moment, was Stephanie Buck.
I'm a Mars One astronaut candidate, and so I was here to ask him questions about his thoughts on an international mission to go to Mars.
And this was one of those great Comic-Con moments where people's real interest in science fiction got to meet real science.
Nina, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Nina Gregory talking to us from Comic-Con in San Diego.
The annual San Diego Comic-Con is in full swing, a celebration not just of comics, but movies, television, books, video games, and really elaborate costumes. It's called cosplay. That's the art and science of dressing up like your favorite character. And NPR's Petra Mayer is very familiar with cosplay. We sent her to see the sights.
Oh my God, zombie Teletubbies. That's the best thing ever. Well, the best thing ever for the next 10 minutes. Nice. I see some vintage Star Trek. I appreciate that. I see a 10th Doctor. I've seen at least 10 Elsas from Frozen, a dozen Daenerys Targaryens, Lady Thors and Lokis, and a really, really cool Silver Surfer in body paint that must have taken him hours. And today, I'm one of them. Every other day of my life, I'm Petra Mayer, mild-mannered books editor. But today, I am embodying one of my favorite characters in all of comics, Spider Jerusalem, the swaggering, world-changing, foul-mouthed and foul-minded journalist of the future, star of the old Transmetropolitan comics. My costume is, shall we say, endearingly homemade, knocked together with wire, epoxy, and acrylic paint. I am a rank amateur compared to Haley Lindsay.
My costume is Toothless.
Toothless is the star of the How to Train Your Dragon films. And inside is 12-year-old Haley, who made the costume with help from her dad.
For the saddle and stirrups and everything, I did everything except cut them out and rivet them together. I smoothed out the edges and everything and engraved the saddle so it looked kind of like it was braided.
Seriously, this costume looks like so much work. But to Haley, it's worth the effort.
The happy faces and everyone complimenting me on the costume and everything, and it's just really awesome.
And that's another part of the joy of it, seeing people's faces just light up. And the freedom. I'm dressed as a man. Haley's a dragon. And Xavier de Guzman?
I'm dressed up as the mom from Supernatural.
Describe your costume for me.
It's a white gown, blonde wig, and silky red blood.
I like how we're both cross-playing. I'm a guy, and you're a girl.
Yeah.
Xavier's friend Jesse Gonzalez isn't wearing a costume, but he's definitely enjoying the sights, like one family that stepped out as Star Wars.
You'll see a dad that's Leia, you'll see a mom that's Han Solo, you'll see like a little Chewbacca that's like a little girl. It's amazing. I don't know. When I have kids, I'm going to bring them here, and that's going to happen.
Now, Jesse and Xavier did actually recognize my costume, but they were just about the only ones. I needed some validation, so I went by the Vertigo booth, Vertigo being the imprint that published the Transmetropolitan books back in the day.
Can I take a picture of you as Spider Jerusalem?
You may. Turns out I just met Ray Miller, who manages Derek Robertson.
Who is the co-creator and artist on Transmetropolitan.
Only a Comic-Con man. Thank you. But after everything, all the joy, all the freedom, all the swagger, you still have to get home and take your costume off. And I learned one very important lesson in all this. If you forget the spirit gum for sticking down your bald cap, don't try to fudge it with liquid latex. Ow. Petra Mayer, NPR News, San Diego.
If you want to take a look at Petra as Spider Jerusalem and other costumes like zombie Teletubbies, you can come to our website, npr.org. This summer, we're profiling young people with unusual jobs. So let us introduce you to a man who gets paid full-time to dress up as a Tyrannosaurus Rex. NPR's Kirk Siegler sent us this story from the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles.
So you know that scene in Empire Strikes Back where Han Solo slices open the belly of a Tauntaun so Luke can stay warm when they're lost on Hoth? It's not really that different from how Eli Presser climbs into a 75-pound feathered T-Rex dinosaur costume.
So right now I am putting on some Velcro straps that are going to attach my feet to our T-Rex, and it's also going to let me control his legs.
Then he sticks his head through an opening in the T-Rex's gut and climbs in. You can't see him now, but his head is somewhere inside the puppet's neck, just beneath its gaping mouth and set of yellow spear-like teeth. Eli uses his own legs and a hidden bike brake to operate this giant beast.
And so by pulling on those brakes, I open the mouth and blink the eyes.
Then the best part?
Great, I'm going to unclip you and the doors are still closed.
The vocal box that makes the scary roar. Eli gives it one last test with his boss, Ilana Gustafson, just seconds before his grand entrance into one of the museum's daily dinosaur encounter shows.
And I'm going to go open the door.
Eli and his T-Rex come to life, darting from one side of the stage to the other, mouth opening wide, roaring, lunging at the show's host.
They forgot to feed him!
Warning, the depiction is so realistic it might be frightening for small kids. But 10-year-old Sophia Lindsay leaves impressed.
I liked it when it dropped the lizard out of its mouth and it didn't even notice. I recommend this show for all ages.
Beyond the thrills, Sophia says she also learned a lot. And this is one of the best things about being a master puppeteer, says Eli Presser. He's once again backstage, now wiping sweat from his forehead.
Takes a little wind out of you.
He says he'll never take this job for granted.
I'm very fortunate. I spend my work week is I come in and I either get into a wonderful giant T-Rex puppet and chase and roar at kids and adults. And when I'm not doing that, I'm in my workshop building new puppet shows and discussing arts and science with artists and scientists.
Eli, who's 30, got his start in puppetry at age 15 in his hometown of Chicago. His mom took him to a performance at a local puppet theater. That night, he went home and built his own puppet. He brought it back to the theater the next day, and they hired him as an apprentice. Then came California and art school, and 4 years ago, it all became a full-time job when the museum launched its popular program.
This is a dream job. You know, full-time employment as a puppeteer at a museum where every day I walk through these halls is wonderful.
But don't discount all the physical demands. You gotta stay in shape and stretch a lot if you're gonna operate a 75-pound puppet 4 or 5 times a week.
For me, I'm not very flexible, so a lot of what I end up doing is just trying to keep my hamstrings from getting too tight.
So before his show, you'll find Eli in the green room on a Pilates reformer. In a city full of actors and performers, you might not be surprised to learn that Eli's job is also highly competitive. On the rare occasion that there's an opening for a puppeteer, the museum's Ilana Gustafson will bring in at least 20 applicants for auditions.
Definitely all need to be strong and imaginative, and you'd be surprised how difficult it is to find these puppeteers. It's a very unique mix of skills that we look for.
Skills like agility, but also acting, artistry, and performance. Eli Presser honed a lot of them, working for years as a street performer. And in fact, the favorite part of his job today, when he gets to walk around the museum in the T-Rex costume unannounced, surprising visitors.
It's the same thing I get out of street performing, which is that sense of people encountering puppetry or any kind of performance in places that they do not expect it.
Sure. One minute you're checking out the gazelle diorama. The next, you turn around and there's a giant T-Rex breathing down your neck. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.